We're one member short of a quorum right now, but we are going to get started. We have a full agenda. I'll call the meeting officially to order as soon as we get our next member here. I've had a chance to talk with most of the people who are going to be testifying today. We're going to be doing, we'll call it an overview on bioethics. And we have a number of people who will be providing testimony today. I want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to provide their testimony, and we have to finish by about 2:15. I am meeting with Senator Rest at 2:20, and we've got floor session at 3 o'clock. So we will be finishing by 2:15. The way we're going to run the hearing today is the first five people on the list, Robin Shapiro, Ms. Keem, Dr. Gabriel, Dr. Hartman, and Ms. Anderson, are going to have approximately 50 minutes. I understand that Ms. Shapiro has some testimony. It's going to take a little bit longer than most of the other people. I'd ask members give the testifiers an opportunity to provide their testimony. We'll have a short period for questions with each testifier after they're done, but I want to keep this moving. And so after about 10 minutes, I'm going to ask for the next person to come forward. If we have some time left over at the end of the hearing, we'll have an opportunity to call people back up for additional questions. And after the first five individuals provide their testimony, we'll kind of run through the same process with the second group. Do we have a quorum? All right, I'll call the meeting to order. Representative Davids, thanks for joining us. Representative Davids moves approval of the minutes of the February 2 meeting of the committee.
This seems to be quite accurate.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Any corrections, additions, errors, deletions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. And with that, I guess I would ask Ms. Shapiro if she'd please come forward. If everybody would please identify themselves as they begin their testimony, our hearing is being recorded. So please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. We do have some handouts from Ms. Shapiro and some of the other testifiers. They will be making their way around as they begin their testimony. With that, thank you, Ms. Shapiro. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Chairman Coles, committee members. I am Robin Shapiro. I am a partner, and I am chair of the health law practice at Michael Best & Friedrich, a law firm that's based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm also the Ursula von der Rohe Professor of Bioethics at the Medical College of Wisconsin, where I also direct the Center for the Study of Bioethics. And I'm so pleased to be here. I'm pleased to appear at the request of the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics because I want to discuss with you two critical ethical concerns that accompany any research involving human biological materials. I want to set the stage first by noting that historically, the science of pathology has led the way in the investigation of mechanisms of disease causation. A few examples. In 1953, autopsies of American soldiers who were killed in the Korean conflict revealed that atherosclerosis begins much earlier than we had previously thought, and that actually blockage of arteries can be quite advanced without any symptomatology at all. And this, of course, led to findings about diet and about exercise that have had a major public health impact in this country. Another example, more than 30 years ago, a series of studies on tissue samples of precancerous lesions of the uterine cervix led to the routine use of pap smears, which we know, of course, have played a very important role in the early diagnosis and more successful treatment of cervical cancer. Analysis of autopsied lung tissue obtained from smokers played a significant role in establishing that smoking causes cancer and that the risk of cancer increases with the duration of exposure to chemicals in cigarette smoke. So these are just a few historical examples about how human biological materials have proven to be invaluable resources for a wide variety of studies aimed at understanding both the etiology and the progression of disease and the effects of the environment on our health. This is going to continue to be true. In fact, it's going to be all the more true as we enhance our ability to identify genes that may be responsible for underlying mechanisms of disease. The range of medical benefits that have been and that certainly will continue to be obtained through this kind of research is simply enormous. So with that background, I'd like to also note that the Minnesota Partnership is a collaborative acknowledgement of and at the same time investment in this kind of research, through which we've seen, will continue to see substantial breakthroughs that promise to enhance medicine's diagnostic and therapeutic potential even more. But the reason that I'm here, I suppose, is that the power of these new capabilities does raise a number of ethical issues and the need to assure that the pursuit of these important scientific aims doesn't compromise the rights and the welfare of human subjects of research. Currently in this country, the oversight of the use of biologic materials in research is grounded in federal regulations. These regulations include the Federal Policy for the Protection of Human Subjects, also called the Common Rule, and the FDA regulations. Now, the Common Rule is a set of regulations that was adopted independently by 17 federal agencies. That's why it's called the Common Rule. And the FDA regulations apply to any research on products, devices, and drugs that are subject to purview by the FDA. For reasons that I'm going to get to in just a moment, I believe that this paradigm, these current federal regulations, do succeed in protecting the rights and the interests of research subjects while at the same time permitting to go forward well-designed research using biological materials already in storage as well as biological materials that are newly collected, both by doctors in clinical course and by investigators. Over the past few years, I've had the pleasure and the honor of working with Mayo, and I've seen that that institution consistently and meticulously adheres to this federal law. To get into the specific ethical issues that I want to just briefly comment about, one concern that really has fueled quite a bit of debate about the use of biological materials in genetic research relates to privacy. The power of science and technology to find just an extraordinary amount of detailed information in a single cell raises concerns about the discovery and the use of this kind of information without an individual's consent and possibly to their detriment. More specifically, there are some who fear that personal genetic and other medical information about them could be used discriminatorily in employment, in terms of access to benefits like health or life insurance, or in other ways that's stigmatizing. But there are protections against such use in the federal regulation about which I've referred already. The federal regulations include in the definition of human subjects research to which the federal rules apply. In that definition of what is human subjects research, which means that we have to then care about what the federal regulations say. The definition is any systematic investigation that's designed to develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge and that involves obtaining data about individuals either through intervention or interaction with the individual, so that would be through a test, through some kind of interaction with the individual, or getting identifiable private information. If you have one or the other, you are then subject to the regulations that I've referred to having to do with human subjects protections. In other words, these human subjects protections cover research that uses identifiable private information like genetic information derived from tissues in storage, even if there's going to be no human interaction with the research subjects themselves. So a while back, you gave your tissue to become part of a repository. If there is research done then on that tissue in a way that is privately identifiable, that's research even though there's going to be no contact at the point of the research with your body. Please feel free. This is complicated, I think. So if it's all right with the chairman, I'd like to invite questions as I proceed. Now, most repositories of human biological materials that are used in research have both identifiable specimens, and by that I mean those that are linked to personal information in a way such that the person from whom the material, the tissues came, could be identified, as well as unidentified specimens, so those where we never got any personal information to link up to them, or if we did, it wasn't maintained and it can't be retrieved. Whenever investigators obtained identifiable specimens, the research is subject to the federal regulations. In other words, if researchers want to use stored biological specimens or tissues for the research, and the type of specimens that they use are those that can be or that are connected to the individuals from which these tissues came, the research is subject to the federal regulations, and in that case, two basic protections for human subjects generally come into play. First, the research subject's prior informed consent, bless you, for use of his or her biological materials in the research is usually required. The person from whom the biological specimens came has to have agreed in advance that their tissue could be used in the research. And the second protection is that there has to have been prior review of the research proposal by an institutional review board, IRB, a research committee, that has to determine that the research proposed involves an acceptable balance between risks and benefits. If the specimens are not individually identifiable in that they can't be linked to the specific individuals by the researchers, either directly or through a coding system, then the federal regulations would not apply to that research and the requirement of this additional informed consent would not come into play. And this is appropriate when you think about it because since anonymous samples would be used, you wouldn't have fears about discrimination and stigmatization, with no possibility of linking the data obtained from the sample to a particular individual with from whom the sample came. There simply would not be the possibility of using that data in a way that would be discriminatory or otherwise adverse to that person. So the federal regulations make sense. In August of this past August, the Office for Human Research Protections of the Department of Health and Human Services came out with guidance to the research community that clarified that research involving coded specimens would not be considered research and subject to these federal regulations only if the specimens were not collected specifically for the research project through interaction with the individual and the investigators could not readily obtain the identity of the individuals to whom the specimens pertain. Again, in these circumstances, the data obtained from a biological sample couldn't be used to harm the sample donor because the sample couldn't be linked to the donor. But unless these stringent conditions are met, the research would be subject to the federal regulations. Now, we have to note that those regulations, even if they apply, and I hope you're with me at least part of the way, even if the research regulations are applicable to a certain protocol, there are exemptions from certain requirements that really also makes sense. The exemption provisions in the federal regulations say that if the only specimens used in the research protocol are existing at the time the research is proposed, and the information that's going to be recorded by the investigator about the subjects isn't going to be able to identify those subjects, then that research is exempt from the informed consent and the research review requirements. But again, this exemption is not going to apply when the information collected about the research participants can be linked to them. It won't apply. The exemption won't apply then. If it can be linked to them, the protections of informed consent and IRB review will be applicable And it's then that it's important because we face the possibility of abuse of that information. Second ethical issue.
Mr. Shapiro, I apologize for interrupting. I know you're onto the second of the two issues.
Yes.
I just want to let you know that we're almost 15 minutes in.
Okay.
And if you
okay.
can kind of move along
okay.
so we can get
we will up. We will move along more quickly. The second ethical issue has to do with informed consent. This, of course, being another major protection against research abuses. That being that you have to, in order to be sure that you're treating human subjects respectfully and not treating them as an end to somebody else's means, a means to somebody else's ends, you must assure that they give their prior informed consent before you use them in a research protocol. If an investigator wants to collect samples for a specific research protocol, the individuals have to provide prior, voluntary, and knowing informed consent. If the researcher knows that he or she wants to use them in a future protocol, most often there will be specific consent for that as well. When individuals have given initial consent for collection, storage, and general use of their biological samples for future research, and later an investigator wants to use these stored samples, an IRB or research committee may determine that a second specific consent isn't required because there are certain waiver criteria in the federal regulations discussed in more detail in my handout, but those only apply if there are minimal risks to the research subjects and if basically the research could not proceed without a waiver of the informed consent. This is all well thought out, well laid out in the federal regulations in a way that's very protective of research subjects and that's explained in much more detail in my materials. There's also discussion in my materials about what happens when specimens are collected in the clinical course and then later researchers want to access those stored specimens for research. Again, there are protections laid out in the federal regulations about how, under what circumstances, those specimens may be accessed. So to summarize my comments, and again, I do urge you to read through them because I haven't been able to explain them in a way that's sufficiently detailed. There are two principles that I'd like you to walk away with. First, an ethically sound policy of research uses of human biological materials has to reflect a defensible weighing and balancing of protections for privacy and self-determination of the subjects on the one hand, and on the other, access to samples for purposes of conducting clinically beneficial research. Second principle is that any system of research regulation is most likely to achieve its goals if it's as clear and as simple as possible. We have both of those interests, both of those principles satisfied in our current federal regulations. And from my work with Mayo over the years, I know that that institution impeccably and universally follows the letter and the spirit of that regulatory guidance. It will continue to do so through the partnership, and with the support of this legislative body and the people of Minnesota, you will promote the goal of improving health through biomedical research while protecting the rights and interests of those individuals who contribute to human knowledge through the gift of their biological material. I don't know if I have time for questions or...
Ms. Kerr, I do have a brief question. You've talked about the federal regulations. Are there complementary state regulations that govern this type of research?
Not in Minnesota, to my knowledge, but more than that, not in any state, to my knowledge, that are significant. And there's a reason for that. There are two reasons for that. One, as I say much more clearly, I think, in my written materials than I was able to get to today, the federal regulations are appropriate and comprehensive. Number two, to the extent that we have varying sources of regulations, it becomes less likely that we will have a set of rules that are clear, that are simple, and that are complied with. So, A, it's not necessary, and B, it could confuse things. And that's why states throughout the country rely on these federal regulations that we've lived with successfully for many years.
But I didn't hear you say that the regulations are preemptive. In other words, if a state wanted to go down this road, I'm not suggesting that we do, but if we did want to go down this road, the federal regulations are not preemptive.
That's right.
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, and guests, just a brief comment, really more than a question, but I am personally a control in a research study at Mayo Clinic, just randomly selected, and so I have rather recently been through the process of this informed consent and so on, and I guess I can add my personal experience that Mayo is extremely thorough. I allowed the use of my blood for, you know, further purposes somewhere down the road, and they are very thorough in obtaining the consent of the patient and explaining what it's going to be used for, and, you know, different levels of consent are requested, and et cetera. So I just want to add that note that I do believe you're correct when you say that they're very thorough in complying with the requirements.
And I have, because of the nature of my two jobs, I have the pleasure of being acquainted with a number of research institutions throughout the country. And I can say without a doubt that I would absolutely agree that with your comments, and go further and say that more than any other institution that I work with, I'm going to get in trouble here from my own home, but there's extreme care and thought in assuring that these regulations are understood and applied in the right way.
Thank you very much, Ms. Shapiro.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming. And members, Ms. Shapiro has to leave to catch a plane. She's the only one who's not going to be available for questions later on if we do have some time. But I'm sure she'll be happy to follow up with you if you do have further questions. Ms. Keene, could you please identify yourself for the tape?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Moira Keene, and I am the director of the department at the University of Minnesota that we call the Research Subjects Protection Programs. And that's actually the department that houses and manages the work of the Institutional Review Board that Ms. Shapiro has just described, and the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee. So we manage both the human and animal research regulatory and ethical oversight out of my office. And I want to thank you for the privilege of meeting with you today to talk about the privacy and confidentiality issues that we face on a daily basis. I believe that Ms. Shapiro has given us a very good introduction into the scope of the federal regulatory environment. And I want to emphasize just a few points, and I hope leave enough time for questions and give an opportunity for my colleagues in our partnership to speak to some of the very specific issues that you're facing on this committee. First of all, I want to emphasize that the infrastructure that Ms. Shapiro described as the federal oversight system is, in fact, a very strong and compelling infrastructure for research institutions. Any institution in this country that receives federal monies for research engages in an assurance process with the federal regulatory agency, the Office for Human Research Protections, or OHRP. That's an office out of the Secretary for Health and Human Services Division of the federal government. And we, like Mayo and other institutions around the country, have really made almost a contractual agreement with that agency, agreeing that we will uphold and enforce all of the federal rules and regulations that pertain to protecting human subjects. Those extend to the rules and laws that Ms. Shapiro discussed. There are other regulations and rules in place, the HIPAA regulations. Certainly in this state we have very compelling state laws about protecting research subjects' records and medical records. All of those rules apply when we are reviewing research proposals that come to us. We also have, of course, institutional policies and practices that create another overlay on the federal regulations. As you stated, Mr. Chair, the regulations are, in fact, the basic framework or the floor that we must achieve in order to allow human subject research to go forward. Institutions may embellish on those rules to add extra protections as necessary. And, in fact, in some instances, we do insert an institutional presence on those regulations to make them as safe as possible for research participants. There are also professional codes of conduct in place for a number of the research professions who are present when we are doing research with human tissues and samples. And, of course, there are boards and licensure requirements in place for many of those professionals. I want to assure you that there are many thoughtful people around the country who are working on these very same issues of privacy and confidentiality. I have the pleasure of serving on the Secretary of Health and Human Services Committee on the Protection of Human Subjects. I've been appointed to a subcommittee with that particular group. It's the SACHARP group. And we'll be meeting on our first meeting on Monday to discuss some of the very issues in that common rule that Ms. Shapiro described for you. Privacy and confidentiality, the need for additional guidance and protection in those areas is certainly very high on the agenda for that subcommittee. So with this web of existing laws and rules, institutions like the University of Minnesota, and I believe like the Mayo Clinic, and I'll let my colleagues describe their process, but we have, we believe, a very safe and secure infrastructure for protecting the rights and welfare of research subjects, whether they are actively involved in clinical contact or if they are involved in our basic survey research that we conduct. I do want to emphasize that I believe, and my colleagues at the University of Minnesota believe in most instances, that what we need really is more guidance from the federal agencies, more guidance at the state level in terms of how to proceed. We don't need restrictive laws. What we are looking for is bolstering the infrastructure with the appropriate resources to assure that we can protect research subjects. With the advent of additional medical technologies, as well as information technology, the need for protecting privacy of the individual and confidentiality of the data has become very acute. We are very sensitive to that at large research institutions. We don't want to have problems that will get in the way of furthering science that will protect the citizenry of this state. So I would like to just conclude my brief remarks by saying that that we take to heart, and very personally, in fact, at our institution, the need to protect the scientific endeavor, but also to protect the integrity of the individuals who give us a gift of participation when they agree to be in our research projects. And I would encourage you to consider those aspects of this work when you proceed with your deliberations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Wilkin has a question.
Thank you, Dr. Keene. You touched on some very important areas. There are some others that haven't been addressed yet, and I'm wondering if you could comment on them. They're a little more controversial. They're the embryonic stem cell research, cloning, and animal-human hybrid, and what kind of debate has been going on at the university specifically. How are we fleshing out both sides of that debate? And how the university, is the university, have they begun their embryonic stem cell research that they announced last year? And if so, how are they dealing with the current statute?
Ms. Keene, that's a number of questions, but why don't you try to take a stab at as many of them as you can. Thanks.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representatives, I came today to address issues of confidentiality and privacy in the context of the federal regulatory environment. I will say that in that context, the rules and regulations that we're talking about would apply to all tissue samples, all biological products that are involved in the research infrastructure. In terms of the university's activity in some of those other areas, I would have to defer to other experts at our institution to answer your specific questions.
And Mr. Chairman, are we going to hear from anyone from the U with that regard? Or?
Representative Wilkin, we don't have anybody on the list to discuss that presently, but if we have some people, or if you have some people in mind, or if you'd like to further, I'm sure this topic isn't going to go away, and I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to discuss this more.
That'd be nice for another hearing. I would appreciate that.
Thank you, Ms. Keene.
Thank you.
Dr. Gabriel.
If you wish, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Hartman and I could do this together, and perhaps we could even take questions together. It might save you a bit of time.
That'd be great. If you could both please identify yourselves prior to beginning your testimony.
Okay. I'll start. Thank you. Chairman Coles, members of the division, my name is Shireen Emily Gabriel. I'm a physician and researcher at the Mayo Clinic, where I'm professor of medicine and epidemiology and chair of the Department of Health Sciences Research. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics, where Mayo Clinic is an active partner. My testimony today will address two issues: the critical importance of medical records research to the medical record itself, to life-saving research, and the fact that Mayo holds the privacy and confidentiality of patient information paramount. Our institutional motto, as I'm sure many of you have heard, is the needs of the patient come first, and confidentiality is considered one of the utmost needs of our patients. It was at Mayo Clinic where the unit medical record was conceived in 1907 and where patient-oriented research has been ongoing for nearly 100 years, and I'm proud to say I serve as chair of the department that serves as a steward for those data. Throughout the past century, our patients have maintained their trust and confidence in our medical care and in our processes of keeping their information secure. That trust is exemplified by the fact that more than 97% of our patients grant us authorization to use their medical information for research. Today at Mayo, this information refers not only to paper or computerized records of a patient visit, but also to the results of tests, analyses, tissue samples, blood or serum, and cellular materials. These are all collected when patients consent to their medical care. Mayo Clinic and the Minnesota Partnership do not merely meet, but strive to exceed all federal and state regulations, ensuring patient confidentiality. Let me assure you that we were securing and safeguarding patient information long before many of today's regulations existed. Moreover, all research is under the control and review of the Institutional Review Board, as you've just heard, a federally mandated regulatory body that ensures that patients' rights are protected in every research project. If a patient informs us that they wish to be notified each time their samples are used for research, we fully comply with that request, or we do not use their samples at all. If we have a compelling research need to study a patient sample that was collected some years ago, say for a genomic analysis, a research technology that didn't even exist when the sample was collected, then we seek to obtain permission. However, in some instances, such as when the patient's no longer alive, federal regulation, as you heard Dr. Shapiro speak on, federal regulation allows the IRB to examine the research protocol and on a case-by-case basis permit use of the medical records provided that confidentiality is not put at risk, that the benefits of the research are clear, and that no patient identities are ever retained. And let me emphasize that the Institutional Review Board does not report to the Mayo Clinic or any institution where it lives. It's responsible solely to the federal government, and its primary reason for existence is to protect the rights of the patient or the research subject. It includes members of the public and ethicists, as well as scientists and physicians. Many research protocols are rejected every single year because they fail to meet IRB scrutiny. Any Mayo researcher will tell you that these safeguards are real, they're in place, and that they're enforced by the IRB, which acts as an independent body of review. Now let me comment on my second point, the crucial importance of the patient record to the public health. If researchers had not been allowed to study the medical records of patients with immune deficiency problems back in the 1970s, AIDS would not have been identified as a global threat for years. Lyme disease was characterized from the medical records of children in Lyme, Connecticut. The medical record was critical to studies that alerted us to the health risks of smoking, of dietary fasts, and of obesity. Medical records research has also led to vaccines for polio, measles, and other infectious diseases. More recently, patient records, some going back for generations, have alerted us to genetic susceptibility to a number of diseases, including breast cancer. Additionally, long-term patient-based studies warn us about the side effects of certain drugs and support new genomic findings about drug intolerance that could prove fatal. What that helps us do is avoid those drugs in certain patients. Use of the medical record allowed Mayo Clinic to define osteoporosis as a disease that could be treated and not simply an inevitable part of growing old. That research has helped thousands prevent bone loss and life-threatening fractures from brittle bones. Review of patient records back 50 years allowed endocrinologists at Mayo to confirm that traditional treatments for the most severe form of thyroid cancer do not improve life expectancy, that the use of external radiation can slow the local progression of the disease, and that more inventive approaches to management of this disease are needed. As a direct result of these kinds of studies, prospective trials of new therapies are now underway to help deal with this deadly human cancer. Finally, just an example from my own research group. We just discovered, in fact reported it just last week, that people with rheumatoid arthritis, I'm a rheumatologist, that's my clinical specialty, that people with rheumatoid arthritis are twice as likely to suffer from heart attacks, heart failure, and to die from heart disease. In some cases, the risk of heart attack is five times as great. Now that we understand that there's this great risk for people with RA, We must understand why. Is it the medication they're taking to treat arthritis? I'm sure many of you are aware that a recent arthritis medication was taken off the market recently because of its association with heart disease. Or is there some genetic variation that makes people with arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, susceptible to both RA and atherosclerotic disease? Were it not for our ability to access the records and information of more than 1,000 patients at Mayo, we couldn't have made this discovery. Lives would continue to be at risk, and we'd still be in the dark about it, and we wouldn't be working to identify a solution to try and understand why is it that these patients have an increased risk of heart disease. Time limitations prevent me from listing dozens of other life-saving studies that wouldn't have been possible without access to patient information and corresponding medical samples. Let me simply say that we cannot deliver the best care to every patient every day, which is Mayo's mission, if we do not continue to evaluate that care and use that knowledge to improve the care that we give our future patients. Failing to do so will cost lives now and in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shapiro. Dr. Hartman.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Dr. Gabrielle.
Thank you. Members of the committee. I'm Lynn Hartman. I'm a professor of oncology at Mayo and the director of our women's cancer program in the cancer center there. I'm a medical oncologist. I care for patients with cancer, and I also conduct research in women's cancers, especially ovarian and breast cancer. And I've been asked to comment today on key questions in ovarian cancer as one example of an important problem in women's health and how research is brought to bear on those questions. I'm sure I don't have to remind you that very recently cancer surpassed heart disease as the number one cause of death in Americans. Of the cancers unique to women, ovarian cancer has the highest death rate. Many women diagnosed with it die of it. My patients with ovarian cancer and their loved ones typically have three questions for me. First, why did I get this? What caused this to happen? Second, what can you do for me? And third, what's going on to prevent this from happening in my daughters? Behind every one of those questions is an assumption that we are working through research to find the answers. Well, how do we approach these questions? First, what caused the cancer? And when you're talking about genomics, I want to show you something. I'd like to show you right here the control tower, if you will, of a cell. These are the chromosomes, the normal chromosomes.
Excuse me, Dr. Hartman. Members, that's in your packets. There's a photocopied version of that and with Dr. Hartman's testimony.
So basically, every cell in her body has this complement of chromosomes, which is where all of her genes are, that tell the cells how to do their work. That same woman's ovarian cancer looks like this. It is wild. The chromosomes, the genes there are completely out of control. It is that loss of control that will let these cells take over her organs and ultimately take her life. We want to study the genes of these cancers and other cancers through genomics, through this partnership, to learn how could such a process possibly begin and what sustains it. That's her first question, and we're on that. Second, what can you do for me? We know that surgery and chemotherapy are standard treatments for ovarian cancer, and yet, despite that, 8 out of 10 women with advanced stage disease will die of their disease. What we want to do is study the genetic profiles of these ovarian cancers that were diagnosed years ago, and we know who did well with a particular type of chemotherapy and who did not do well. Then we can study the tumor of the patient diagnosed today, look at the profile of her tumor, try to predict which treatment would be most beneficial for her. If, for some reason, we could not study tumors that had been obtained years ago, let's say the women had died, we could not get their consent, we would not be able to analyze the most lethal of these conditions, the ones that we need to study the most. her question, what about my daughters? What will you have for her? That requires a very deep understanding of causation and early changes so that we can adopt methods to prevent and detect these conditions early. Both require good resources, particularly new technology. So to do all of this, we need to be able to analyze specimens that have been obtained in the past for which we have outcomes information. Who did well? Who did not? If we can't use those samples, as I've already mentioned, especially for those where women have died, we are missing some very important information. Similarly, if we couldn't use the medical record to determine how people did or what treatment they had received, it would be like driving cars, if you will, without the crash test results that happened. In closing, I would like to reiterate just a few points. The people of Minnesota have very high expectations of their biomedical institutions. They expect us to be studying the major health problems that challenge us. I would like to reemphasize that there are strong and robust control mechanisms in place to protect research participants from harm. Our IRB stands above the highest institutional leaders at Mayo in performing its responsibilities. And lastly, research benefits patients. It benefits the patients of today and the patients of tomorrow. It is the role of the IRB, following federal policy, to evaluate the balance between likely benefit and possible harm in each and every study.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman. Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the doctors, thank you very much for all that you do. Your research is very important, and we're proud to have Mayo in the state. But there are other ethical considerations out there, and I'm a little disappointed that they haven't been addressed, and that's just what I said before. The embryonic stem cell research, cloning, and animal-human hybrids, and that one pretty much came out of the blue to me. I was reading an online article from National Geographic, and I know the Mayo has some involvement in that area. It's limited at this point, but I'm curious as to what extent the plan is. How far do they plan to go down that road? And I'm wondering if either of you would care to comment on that.
Dr. Gabrielle or Dr. Hartman?
Well, I could tell you that as far as I know, that those areas are really not being actively pursued at Mayo. I have some other colleagues here that can speak to that, but that's the reason we didn't cover them. It's really not an area of active research for us.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilkins.
There's a January 25th article in National Geographic News about Mayo Clinic creating a pig with human blood flowing through it. Now, that's most likely not very problematic ethically, but if you go down the road further with some experiments that are being tried elsewhere where they're putting basically they're moving more and more toward the human and putting growing human brains in mice in California. I don't think this is new news. This isn't anything that I'm just bringing up out of the blue. It's These are ethical questions that I would expect the U of M and Mayo to address, especially since they're coming here for some pretty serious funding for the genomics project.
We'd have to look at that and get back to you. I'm honestly not familiar with what you're referring to, but I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Yeah, I would appreciate it.
Just one thing to mention, we sometimes use animal models for particular types of research and grow a human cancer, brain cancer in a mouse to try to study what the pattern of that is, because there's no human model that we can use ethically, obviously. That's not a cloning. That's not trying to make a human-animal hybrid. That's and that type of animal research is very carefully regulated And so when you talk about human brain material in a mouse, that's what comes to my brain.
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, Doctor, I appreciate that, and I agree with you on what you described. What the article described is somewhat different, and I'd be happy to share that with you, and sure. Maybe we can get your comments afterwards.
That. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wilkin raises some very important points, I think, and I know that there are many members, there are many representatives of the partnership here, and the partnership is coming before the legislature asking for a significant amount of money, and I'm supportive of what they're of the research that the partnership wishes to do, but there are some limits that we as the legislature certainly are going to be concerned about, and how far are we going to authorize the state money that may be on the table to go. And I think the questions that Representative Wilkin is raising are very important, and I hope and trust that the partnership will provide the committee with additional information prior to the time that the appropriation bill is here before the committee for consideration. Okay. So I'm sure the questions will be raised at that time, and so I hope and trust that that will be forthcoming. I guess with that, I'd like Ms. Anderson to come down, and we've got about 5 minutes left before we're going to move on to Twyla Brace and others. So, Ms. Anderson, I apologize that we're leaving you only with 5 minutes, but I hope you can confine your comments to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I am Lynn Anderson of Plymouth, Minnesota. I'm a corporate attorney, but I'm here today as a patient. I've been a resident of our great state of Minnesota for all of my 52 years and a patient at Mayo Clinic for most of my adult life. Breast cancer killed my grandmother. Breast cancer killed my mother. I do not want breast cancer to kill me or my sister. When my mother Marlene was 18 years old and about to graduate from Duluth Denfeld, her mother Minnie was diagnosed with breast cancer. There was no treatment. My mother, an only child, cared for her mother until her mother's death in 1943. My mother's greatest fear was developing breast cancer. In 1985, she was diagnosed with breast cancer at Mayo Clinic and had a mastectomy. She made it almost 5 years before the breast cancer metastasized, taking over her body one body part at a time, starting with a lung. My younger sister, Patty, and I cared for my mother as she cared for her mother. We knew that my mother's greatest fear of having breast cancer was losing her sight, as her mother had lost her sight. My mother loved life and did not want to ever miss a moment of seeing her family, especially her grandson, Timothy. So when she was diagnosed at Mayo Clinic with breast cancer, that in fact had spread to her eyes, my mother asked her physicians, "How are you going to treat it so that I do not go blind?" Her Mayo Clinic physicians told us that it was rare, very rare, for breast cancer to metastasize to the eyes, and that at Mayo Clinic they only saw 5 patients a year. To know how to treat, physicians have to be able to study all of the patients who went before, including those that have died. Because Mayo had the medical records and had done the medical research on the patients who went before my mother, her physicians knew what treatment worked. My mother's vision was saved. Without that knowledge, there would not have been effective treatment developed. My mother would have been blind, and the disease would have taken her life sooner. In spite of receiving the world's best medical care at Mayo Clinic and having the ultimate will and determination to live, my mother died of metastatic breast cancer in 1996. It was her fervent hope that a cure for cancer would be discovered in time to help her. When it became clear that it would not, she then turned her focus to Patty and me. At every checkup with Dr. Hartman, her oncologist at Mayo Clinic, she asked, "What can be done so my daughters don't get this?" Dr. Hartman would always tell my mother about the medical research underway, and then my mother would always tell her that we had to go faster and find the cure so that another generation is not lost to this dread disease. After we lost my mother, I was then the one that asked, what can be done so my sister and I don't get this? What can we do to reduce the risk based on the best medical information available? I have even asked the specific question of whether I should have a prophylactic mastectomy. Last year, when I asked about what can be done to reduce the risk of breast cancer, the answer surprised. Actually, it shocked me. Dr. Hartman told me that based on recent medical research, that there was a finding that if the ovaries are removed in a premenopausal woman, the risk of breast cancer is reduced 50%. 50%. Medical research is done by going back in time to help the patient of today. So as a patient of today, I searched for all the information I could then obtain. I used that medical research to know my medical choices, assess the risks, and make informed decisions as to my medical care. I had my ovaries removed last October at Mayo Clinic to reduce my risk of breast cancer. Cancer kills. Cancer kills every minute of every day, and I have come to think of it as the biggest terrorist in America. Why wouldn't we fight this war on cancer with every available resource? Mayo Clinic has medical information that can save lives. If you do not allow Mayo Clinic to use this information in its files to the maximum, people will die. Thanks to the brilliant foresight of the Mayo brothers in developing the world's most detailed and organized medical information system, we have a repository of generations of medical information that must all be allowed to be used to fight this war on cancer. How proud we should be as Minnesotans to be the home of Mayo Clinic, world leader in healthcare, and the only institution in the world to have this much organized medical information. Mayo Clinic is using this medical information for life-changing and life-saving research for all of us as patients. Those that know me know that I am a private person. I believe in the sanctity and confidentiality of the physician-patient relationship, including all medical information collected. As a patient, I am convinced that safeguards are in place for the confidentiality of my medical records. After all, I have trusted Mayo with my life and with the lives of my family members. I can certainly trust Mayo to confidentially and responsibly use the medical information that it collects. With the commonality of my name, Anderson, I would deem it mission impossible to track down the heirs of long ago deceased patients for consent for each specific future study, as I suggest, as I understand some may have suggested should be done. Why would we tie the hands of our researchers this way? Please balance the benefit versus the harm. If medical research uses patient information that is pooled and subject to all the safeguards that we've heard today from all of these experts, what is the harm? Who is harmed? There is no real risk to loss of confidentiality. So, Mr. Chairman and representatives, on behalf of my grandmother, my mother, my sister, all who have lost their lives to this war, and those that are fighting for their lives in this war, I implore you not to sacrifice people's lives in this war on cancer to protect the remote possibility of loss of confidentiality. Do not tie the hands of the medical researchers. They are the only ones that can win this war for us, all of us, as patients. Instead, let's celebrate this medical partnership of Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota and give it every possible tool to win this war. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Ms. Brace, we're gonna move on here unless members have very quick questions for Ms. Anderson. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for holding this very important
meeting. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of the Citizens Council on Healthcare, and we have been operating for 10 years as a nonprofit, independent, free market healthcare policy organization. We've long been interested in medical and genetic privacy issues because we know that protecting privacy is the foundation of protecting the citizens' right to liberty and autonomy. And as such, we have been talking to the governor's office and his staff since the initiative was first announced in 2003. The governor's plan has been surrounded by what I can best call a rah-rah atmosphere. A lot of cheerleaders, a lot of hoopla, but not a lot of really good questions that need to be asked and answered. So I'm here to help you ask the critical questions. And this is what I call my one quote, 5 points, and 8 questions testimony. It will be brief. I'm going to share 5 points of concern, each with a question that gets to the heart of the concern or a question or two. And then after I'm done, I will provide you with a well-documented paper that lays out our concerns under each of those questions. So let me begin. The first concern is statutory compliance. There's one question. Why is it that despite a state medical records law, there seems to be organization in Minnesota who was involved in processes designed to circumvent that state law? Second concern, patient consent, and there are two questions. Are patients obligated to participate in medical and genetic research to receive care? And why is it that many patients are included in medical research in Minnesota, although they have never given their consent and do not know they are research subjects? Third concern, government access to patient data, and there's one question. To what extent will the Minnesota Department of Health be able to use state and federal law to do government-based research on citizens using genetic and other medical record data? Fourth concern, ethics and electronics. One question. How well informed is the Minnesota legislature about the research activities taking place at Mayo and the university? And how comfortable would the public be if the public was fully informed? And the fifth and final concern is genetic research itself. And there are 3 questions. What are the implications of unconsented genetic research? What obligations does the state of Minnesota have to taxpayers with regard to taxpayer-funded genetic research? And I'll tell you that when you get to that question in what I'm going to hand out, there's a Gallup poll on what the American public thinks about researcher and state access to their medical records. And then the last question is, what state laws protect citizens against the unconsented use of tissues and body parts for medical or genetic research? Now for the quote, and it comes from Ellen Wright Clayton, who just happens to be speaking in 2 weeks at our public forum on the Governor's Biotechnology Initiative. And it's open, by the way, to the public, and any of you are invited. Dr. Clayton is an expert on genetics and bioethics. She is also a member of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Genomics, and this is what she writes. People may not understand that tissue samples they provide may be used for genetic research. They may believe that samples will be discarded after testing, although the law often requires that samples be retained. When samples are obtained as part of medical care, patients may not be told about the possibility that these samples will be stored and used for research. She goes on to say, one investigator has found that documents used to obtain informed consent in genetic research usually do not inform subjects that the samples they provide may be retained and used for research well into the future, including research on disorders unrelated to those for which the subjects originally provided their samples, and by investigators at other institutions. So, let me charge you with the responsibility of your office to get accurate information from the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota to answer these questions, and while you're at it, from any other medical institution that gathers body parts, blood, serum, tissues, and anything else from patients. And as representatives of the people, I ask you at the end of the day to make sure that you have protected the rights and you've upheld the dignity of the patients and the citizens that are your constituents. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. I don't have a specific question regarding your testimony, but I would request, I received information regarding the the seminar that you made mention of. I'm not sure if other members did. I don't know if that went to all members of the legislature, but if you could see to it that at least the members of this committee are informed of the conference, I'm not sure yet if I'm going to be able to attend, but it's certainly an issue that is at the heart of what this committee is going to be thinking about and considering this session. So if you could make sure that members have the information, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair,
do other members have questions? Thank you, Ms. Brace. Next, the agenda lists Andrea Rao from MCCL. However, the MCCL representative who will be providing some testimony is Laura Giese. Could you please identify yourself for the tape and provide us with your testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Giese, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization of more than 77,000 member families and 241 chapters. Thank you for allowing me to speak here today. I would first like to submit into the record as testimony this DVD and slideshow titled Human Cloning, a Scientific and Ethical Briefing. I come before you to speak to an issue at the forefront of recent debates in bioethics. There has been a consequential push by some in the bioscience field to perform research on stem cells obtained through a process that requires the destruction of human embryos. MCCL is opposed to the destruction of human embryos for research. The law passed by the Minnesota Legislature in 1973, Minnesota Statutes 2004, Section 145.422, Subdivisions 1 and 2, prohibits the destruction of human embryos for research purposes. It is our position that support of embryonic stem cell research further erodes respect for human life, leaving open the door to even more inhumane experimentation. I urge you to consider the immediate and future consequences of this research. A human embryo, however created, is alive. It is not dead or inanimate. A human embryo is human. It is a complete human organism, a member of the human species with its entire DNA at an early stage of development. It is what each of us once was. The pursuit of embryonic stem cell research would require the destruction of millions and potentially billions of human lives in their earliest, most vulnerable stages. Embryos destroyed for stem cell research are being developed in two different ways. Fertility clinics create human embryos by joining the mother's ova and the father's sperm to be used in vitro fertilization. After implanting the healthiest looking embryo or embryos into the woman's uterus, remaining embryos are frozen and saved for possible later use. Proponents of embryonic stem cell research argue that embryos created at fertility clinics but not implanted into a mother's womb are merely spare sets of cells. These cells, they argue, have no moral status, and many of them will be destroyed anyway. Such spare embryos, however, possess their own unique genetic makeup. They are truly alive and fully human. The argument for experimenting on human beings because they may die anyway also poses a grave threat to terminally ill patients, convicted prisoners, and other vulnerable people. Fortunately for these tiny persons, embryos who may have been discarded or used for research purposes in the past may now be adopted by loving parents. The Snowflakes Human Embryo Adoption Program has been very successful in facilitating the adoption of frozen human embryos. With so many parents in the United States waiting to adopt, There is absolutely no reason why human embryos should be discarded or subjected to destructive research. I've included among your handouts in the green folders an article highlighting families who have chosen adoption through the Snowflake program, and you have photocopies of this article in your packet. Because only a limited number of stem cell lines would be yielded using available embryos from fertility clinics, a second process is being promoted to create the embryos. This process is called somatic cell nuclear transfer, also referred to as therapeutic cloning. It should be noted that this is exactly the same process used in reproductive cloning. The difference between the two is merely semantic, depending only on the ultimate use intended for the embryo. Embracing so-called therapeutic cloning could quickly lead to the practice of reproductive cloning, which has equally grave ethical consequences. Until then, by permitting therapeutic cloning, we are creating a class of human beings, unborn cloned humans, who we would legally be required to destroy so they cannot be born. Using embryos for lethal experimentation will ultimately predispose us to a ruthless utilitarianism regarding life. The disabled and elderly are safe in a society that honors life and treats humanity with respect. But if we violate an embryo today, the practice will inure us to violating a fetus, and then an infant, and then infants with defects, then anyone else with a defect. It's the path to social engineering that decides which human lives have value and dignity and which do not. Those in favor of embryonic stem cell research have argued, we must do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Such reasoning is self-defeating. It could lead to the euthanizing of vulnerable persons. Recent history provides tragic examples of attempts to justify gross violation of the rights of human beings in medical research on the utilitarian basis of social and medical benefits. The Tuskegee experiments on African Americans, U.S. government-sponsored radiation research, and the Nazi medical war crimes are a few examples. Embryonic stem cell research is simply incompatible with the principal ethical foundations of medicine. First, do no harm. And the harms such research would bring to medicine would exceed the anticipated benefits. We cannot look upon certain human lives merely as sources for scientific research material. There is a great deal of ongoing stem cell research, which is entirely laudable and is supported by virtually everyone. Research using stem cells taken from adult tissues, placenta, and umbilical cords are ethically non-controversial because they do not require the killing of human embryos. These types of stem cells have already been used in human clinical studies for dozens of conditions, and many of these studies have yielded promising therapeutic results, far beyond anything yet demonstrated with embryonic stem cells.
Ms. Giese, I'm going to ask you to try to wrap it up as quickly as you can.
I have included also in your packet a list of current stem cell treatments using adult stem cells versus embryonic stem cells. And the list on the adult stem cell side continues to grow. In fact, researchers at Tufts University believe they have discovered an adult stem cell that has the same potential as embryonic stem cells. According to a February 2, 2005 Washington Post report, Douglas Lasordo, the Tufts cardiologist who headed up recent research using adult stem cells to repair damaged hearts in rats, said, "I think embryonic stem cells are going to fade in the rearview mirror of adult stem cells." Today, MCCL, on behalf of its 77,000 contributing families and 241 state chapters, urges the state of Minnesota to pursue non-embryonic stem cell research and other promising research that does not depend on the destruction of human lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gizia. Members, I will make the DVD available through Mr. Raines. If people want to take a look at it, they can talk to Mr. Raines. Do members have questions for Ms. Gizia? Thank you, Ms. Gizia.
Thank you.
Next, we have Kirk Allison. Mr. Allison here? Great. As Mr. Allison is getting seated, members, in your packets, there was one email that I received from a woman by the name of Jean Swenson. She asked that it be distributed. It should be in your packets. It's an email that she sent to me along with an article that she, I haven't gone back to confirm this, but I have no reason to doubt that it wasn't published in the St. Paul Pioneer Press on October 21st, 2004, that she wrote regarding this issue. Mr. Allison, thank you for coming. Could you please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony?
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kirk C. Allison, Ph.D. I am the Associate Director of the Program in Human Rights and Medicine in the Medical School of the University of Minnesota. The Program in Human Rights and Medicine is concerned with the confluence, as one could guess, of human rights and medicine, in particular issues regarding vulnerable patient populations. I've titled my remarks, Ethics, Genomics, and the Public Representation of Science. And I think in this regard, some historical background concerning international instruments regarding genomics and further contextual comments regarding the representation of science in public discourse are in order. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this committee and to reflect with you today on the intersection of ethics and genomics. The uniqueness of this confluence is reflected in the Universal Declaration on the Human Genome and Human Rights adopted in 1999 by the United Nations General Assembly. It states, "The human genome underlies the fundamental unity of all members of the human family, as well as the recognition of their inherent dignity and diversity. In a symbolic sense, it is the heritage of humanity. This is of crucial import for every member of society and to future members of society. It is everybody's business, not solely."
Excuse me. Before you get too far down reading your prepared remarks, I've looked through them quickly, and I note that we're not going to have time for you to read your entire remarks. So if you could maybe summarize what's here, I apologize, but we still have additional people who are going to need to testify. So if you could summarize this, all the members have your full testimony, and I don't want to have to cut you off halfway through and move on to the next person. I apologize for that.
Okay. Perhaps I could just read some excerpts and do it in that manner. I think that would be more helpful. It touches on human dignity and identity in an almost unparalleled manner, and it concerns also desperately ill persons who seek therapies, and therefore our responsibilities are great because the vulnerabilities are great. Additionally, given such probity, adherence to the highest standards of candor in public discourse are required ethically, including the duty not to promote claims for effect. As decision makers and policy makers, you will lay down guidelines which will largely affect the cultural practices in the state of Minnesota. The benefits and the costs will be on your shoulders in this regard, not only for the products of the research, but also for the road which is taken. Ferdinand LaSalle noted over a century ago, "For so tangled are ends and means on earth, that one always turns with the other, and other means bring forth other ends." And nothing is so conflated and conflicted by ends and means as genomic research. The International Human Rights Declaration further says, "Recognizing that research on the human genome and the resulting applications open up vast prospects for progress in improving the health of individuals and of humankind as a whole, but emphasizing that such research should fully respect the human dignity, freedom, and human rights, as well as the prohibition of all forms of discrimination based on genetic characteristics. Now, this concerns issues as to the implications of genomic research, particularly in terms of consequences both life-sustaining and life-ending. For example, at the extreme, would it be better off if all persons with congenital disabilities were prenatally eliminated? Would those persons be with congenital disabilities be better off? Is there a morally salient difference between prevention and destruction? It concerns who is welcome in the human family, and one could consider, for example, trisomy underlying Down syndrome, that in some regions 90% of all indicated cases are eliminated prenatally. New and possible technologies raise novel ethical contexts, but the myth of the technological imperative is that ethics should conform itself to technology rather than technology and modes of gaining knowledge to be prudentially conformed to prior ethical commitments. Now, there is particular importance here because, as Jürgen Habermas states, what we're dealing with is the ethical self-understanding of the entire human species. Genomic pursuits have the capacity to alter the nature of the species in morally and materially important ways. For example, one should not be surprised that there are discussions of what a genetically post-human future might look like with genetic enhancement. This concern is why objections in the area of genomics do not break along neat ideological lines. To cite a topic of much import and heated debate, one could note that concerning so-called therapeutic cloning, or better put, research cloning, there is quite an international split. Korea, Britain, and China has approved this, but France, possibly the most secular country in Western Europe, Canada, and Australia, have banned it, and therefore it is not sufficient to ask, will the U.S. be left behind? But also it's incumbent to ask what concerns inform Canada and France to forego possible benefits. Crucially, however, technical advances do not dictate their own application in ethics. Ethically considered, and this is important, there is not a unitary project called genomics. Ethically considered, not everything doable ought to be done. And this should lead us to ask, which genomics, what ethics, and whose ethics? In incremental context, it is worth remembering, as the twig is bent, the tree is inclined. And one should note that an argument that someone else is going to do it is not an argument from ethics at all. For ethics to be ethics in the sense of moral discernment rather than habit or convention, ought has primacy over could and even is. Neither should facts on the ground be confused with ethical justification. Now, one should note also that in many cases, a new technology just raises issues of application of an old principle, such as the privacy issue, which has been well discussed here. For framing discussions of persons with anomalous genetic conditions, Article 2 states that dignity makes it imperative not to reduce individuals to their genetic characteristics and to respect their uniqueness and diversity. Now, this has implications for the public discourse of science. This anti-reductionist clause implies an obligation among scientists not to promote mystification or genetic reductionism in the popular mind. The double helix has become a sort of talisman in public discourse in the pursuit of scarce resources. Additionally, there is the relatively new phenomenon of the entrepreneurial scientist within the university that is not without effect in bioethical contexts. And this, of course, has to do with the commercial state. And now Article 4 states that the human genome in its natural state shall not be a source of financial gains. Article 5, and this concerns also issues of indigenous populations who are being, quote, mined by commercial interests for their genomic information, isolated indigenous groups. The natural state standard, however, does not address the possibility of an induced altered genetic structure in a human embryo, and a commodification of this life akin to the patentability of mice is a specter, but not only. Article 5 concerns informed consent, and I think that is well discussed. Policymakers should ask of actual and proposed technologies, procedures, and policies a few questions, including what risks and burdens does this impose on the vulnerable? Secondly, whose interests are served? And finally, what can we learn from historical precedent? And finally, given that you hold the public purse, you're sure to add, what are the opportunity costs?
Dr. Allison, I'm going to have to ask you to try to tie it up in the next 2 minutes or so. We still have two more testifiers.
Okay. At this point, I think I'll just make a few comments directly in a final discussion concerning the recent Proposition 71, which was passed in California, which you are probably all well aware of. My concern here, and there was an interesting split. There were pro-life, pro-choice, feminists, against. There were corporate interests and other persons for. it was a very unusual coalition of opponents in this particular context. Now, one of my concerns within the voter registration guide, which was the official guide given to every voter in California, the following list of possible diseases occurred: cancer, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, HIV/AIDS, multiple sclerosis, lung disease, and spinal injuries. And this was signed by persons that are the head of, for example, the president of the American Diabetes Association, Alan Charrington, Ph.D., the president of the National Coalition of Cancer Research, and the president of the Parkinson's Action Network. Now, the problem with this list is that HIV/AIDS is in no way a candidate disease. Alzheimer's is also not a good candidate disease. However, they have great rhetorical power in the public mind. And your local car mechanic who doesn't serve PubMed or go to university lectures on stem cells is not aware that HIV/AIDS is not a candidate disease. And yet, this was in the official discussion. Now, on December 8, I raised the voter guide issue with the coordinator of the Southern California Stem Cell Consortium, Professor Evan Snyder, MD, PhD, after his talk, Stem Cell Biology, Good Ethics Depend on Good Facts, and his comments were two concerning this issue. First, that pro-con arguments in the voter's guide were best interpreted as, quote, the politics, not the science of the issue, and B, given that, one can't take the list too seriously as it was based on polling data as to what played well in the public ear. He did not claim responsibility for this state of affairs, incidentally. A layperson who voted yes on Prop 71 because, say, a relative had Alzheimer's or a friend had AIDS did not place their resources in the most productive channels for developing treatments for those diseases. And a standard principle in social welfare economics is that one puts the resources in the most productive channel, and opportunity cost is the difference between that channel and the next used mode of action. To summarize, the intersection of genomics and ethics involves fundamental issues of human identity and the vulnerable. One should not be surprised that fault lines of interest and opinions do not follow stereotypical demarcations. As we can see in the example of France, it is not simply highly religious societies that have problems, say, with therapeutic cloning. Highly secular societies may also. Ethically considered, there is not simply one genomics. And finally, as given from the example of the California Stem Cell Initiative, while good policy requires facts, healthy public discourse relies on ethics and virtues, including the professional virtue of humility. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Dr. Allison. I apologize we had to cut you short. Any questions for Dr. Allison? Thank you very much. Dr. Preston. If you could please identify yourself prior to beginning your testimony, and you may proceed.
Frank Preston, a physician, trained here at the university, and spent some time as a clinical professor in the Department of Family Practice. I see I'm identified as a Catholic, member of the Catholic Medical Society. They don't know it, but I've never paid dues. I go to their meetings.
We won't tell them.
I meet friends there. My message is secular. I hope it's based on science, human rights, and has a moral bend. There are some true, absolute things in science. One is that the world is round. A law of gravity prevails. In 1860, Pasteur's germ theory of disease was proven. Now we all wash our hands a lot. And also in that same decade, Gregor Mendel proved in a body of work called the Mendelian Laws of Heredity, proved that the life of a new individual of any species, animal or plant, begins with fertilization. Notions that somehow life might begin sometime later are completely without any scientific foundation, and the scientists who make those statements no, they're not scientific. They are political or religious or philosophical. And the scientists who speak that have no more expertise than all the rest of us when it comes to philosophy, who should be killed and who should live. The embryo is a being that happens to be human. It's a human being. It's not tissue. It's not the laboratory material, although it's treated and spoken of as though it were. The embryo is not a road map. I visit my granddaughter in Des Moines. I can go to Little Rise. There's Des Moines. The road map's in the glove compartment. They are different things. The embryo is not a blueprint for a house. The house is on the lot. And the blueprint goes downtown. The embryo is not a tool. I put the wrench back in the toolbox. And the faucet still leaks. I'm sorry to say. You've heard the thing that an acorn is not an oak tree, therefore the embryo is not a human. The correct analogy, of course, would be that the embryo is not an adult, and that would be true. But they're different things. An acorn is not an embryo. They're different species. And an oak tree is not an adult human. Never before, I think, in 6,000 years or so, of healers and physicians, except for an aberration in the 1940s in Europe, have physicians taken it upon themselves to kill humans in their research. But you might say, these are frozen. I would ask, who froze them? Who put them in this perilous, dangerous situation? The very same physicians who come to you now and say, they are frozen, we must be allowed to kill them. What should we do then with the frozen embryos? We should do the same thing that we do with other leftover unwanted humans. Look under our bridges, the prisons, the nursing homes, the mental hospitals. We sustain them as best we can, given our resources. We do not kill them for research. We do not kill them for their body parts. In answer to what can we do them after, don't kill them. In England, healthy twins were born after 12 years frozen. There's some people in this room who will not be alive in 12 years. I might be one of them. Adoption is a strong possibility. Artificial wombs, heaven forbid, are another possibility. I will, my information about the university is that they are doing embryo stem cell research on stem cells they purchased in Wisconsin. And they're proposing now to purchase some of Harvard's 17 lines of stem cells. These were all grown on mouse cells and cannot be used. There's some suggestion that maybe they can be grown on human serum, but that's never been tried, and it's unpublished. And it's patented, by the way. So buying stem cells from Wisconsin reminds me of the ethical dilemma of a young father in Germany in the 40s who was poor and the black market prices were high and winter was coming and he was unemployed, but his wife's brother was employed. He worked for the SS in one of the camps, and he had a collection of gold teeth. And he offered some of these gold teeth or gold fillings to his brother-in-law. Should he accept that? They were not killed for his benefit. He did not kill them. He might have even been politically opposed to killing them. Even though he would have moral objections to killing Jews simply because they were subhuman, or moral objections to killing them for their teeth, he might be tempted if his children were hungry.
Dr. Preston, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up as soon as you can here. We have one more testifier yet.
Yes, sir. A couple lines from Longfellow. In his old age, he wrote a long narrative poem about things, sad things he'd seen in life. He imagined looking through a foggy window at a pine tree whose branches were blowing in the wind. And underneath those branches was the grave of a little child who died upon life's threshold and never wept nor smiled. In Longfellow's day, the life's threshold was unknown. It was proven just shortly before he died.
Thank you, Dr. Preston. Dr. Preston, you raised some good points, some things that, frankly, I very much agree with you on and am concerned about. I think, in fairness to the U and to Mayo, the partnership proposal, of course, I think it's worthwhile pointing out that they're not here asking for money to do stem cell research. However, they're asking for money to do research, and the issue of what that research is going to be and whether and what kinds of restrictions the legislature puts on that research, I think, go to the questions that Representative Wilkin was asking earlier, and you raised some things that certainly give us food for thought as we move down this road. So thank you very much for coming and providing your testimony. Ms. Polk, if you'd please come down.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jo Tolk, and I'm the director of Human Life Alliance. And I'm going to try to keep this to 3 minutes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Human Life Alliance is an association of pro-life Minnesotans founded in 1977, and we encourage you to consider the ramifications of state investment in stem cell research. Whereas we are in full support of stem cell research, we are directly opposed to embryonic stem cell research while encouraging adult and cord blood stem cell research. So I want to specify that difference. First, let me say that the reason that we're opposed to embryonic stem cell research is because it's the destruction of human life at its very beginning. This is not philosophy or religious conjecture, is scientific fact. A newly conceived child of a woman and a man, the joining of the sperm and the egg, can only be human. It cannot be a dog, a cat, or any other animal. Two human parents can only produce a human offspring. All major biologists are in agreement with this statement. On the other hand, both adult stem cell and cord blood stem cell research provide us with the hope of life-saving and life-changing medical treatments. Embryonic stem cell research has yet to provide any successful treatments despite over 20 years of private funding. So I want you to keep that in mind. It's not that there hasn't been funding there. I think you've got the handout that gives you some examples. And so I won't read those to you. I'll just let you read them yourselves. Spinal cord injury is one that's been in the news, certainly with Christopher Reeve. So I would encourage you to read that, the breakthroughs that have been made with adult stem cell research. And we put this together last minute, so I'm going to tell you that the last example is the same person as the first example, so you don't think we're trying to slip one in there. We discovered that on the way. We have volumes of information in our office. So, again, you've got another handout that was provided to you. It has a whole page listed of successes with adult stem cell and cord blood stem cell research. And I would say that we know that adult stem cell research has been successful in treating over 100 different kinds of diseases. We have many, many pages, files of documentation in our office. So I would encourage you to contact us if you have any questions. I'll let you read through this yourselves. And 3 minutes.
Thank you very much for your testimony, members. Do you have questions for Ms. Tolk? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Members, that's going to conclude our testimony for today. Watch your email. I suspect that we will not have a meeting next Thursday. However, the following Thursday, if we continue to have this time slot, we probably will. I'll be in touch with Chairman Wilkin regarding that. I suspect that at that meeting we may have a bill or two, including a tax credit bill, a research and development tax credit bill, and any others that that members may have. Again, Mr. Raines has the DVD that MCCL provided. If people want to take a look at that, they can contact him. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.